Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, is housing first the answer to ending homelessness? It's an urgent question because Minnesota, along with a number of other states and cities, has set ambitious goals on finding shelter for everyone who needs it. We know what doesn't work. Decades of investment in temporary shelters and other programs has not ended homelessness. There are still thousands of people in America and here in Minnesota who are chronically homeless. What does work? That's our conversation today, and I'm interested in your view of this. Housing First places people into long-term housing and doesn't require them to be sober or working first. We're going to get into the details about that. But as a taxpayer, how does that sound to you? I'd also like to hear from you if you or someone in your family has experienced homelessness. What do you understand about it that is often missed? So your own experience with this, your familial experience with this is really essential, I think, to the conversation today. But I also, as you hear us develop this idea of housing first, I want to know how you feel about it as a taxpayer whose state funds are being invested into programs like this. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Kathy Tenbroek is with us. She's with the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. Pleasure to have you in the studio. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carrie.
Aaron Stover-Wright is a research director at the Institute for Community Alliances, and he's with us from Des Moines, Iowa. And Aaron, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Kathy, I'm interested in whether setting a deadline on homelessness, the 2020 deadline, produced any different results than just saying we're all in on this and we're going to find a solution. Is there any difference to just saying we've set a date and we have to reach it?
You know, I think that setting a date for the work that we're doing together does add a level of urgency and focus and priority. I think if we were to say to the broader community, let's all work together and do our best to reduce homelessness,
which is what went on for many years,
yep.
Right?
Or even manage the problem. I think we would inspire less excitement and energy and motivation. I think by setting a date and showing actually that we can hit certain targets. So, for example, we set a date around ending veteran homelessness. Now, we haven't hit it yet. But I think because we set the date to do that, we had very focused, very collaborative work, frankly, bipartisan support at all levels of government to get that job done. That included new investments. And I think if we hadn't set that date and made that such an urgent goal, I don't think we would have seen the investments that we've seen. And we are on the verge in Minnesota of ending veteran homelessness.
And so, Aaron, what's your take on setting these, I don't want to say hard and fast deadlines, but the focus that Kathy suggests brings to it when you set a deadline?
No, I don't think I could agree with Kathy more strongly. We had the same thing happen here in Des Moines and in Iowa. We addressed veterans' homelessness with a plan laid out by the Interagency Council. So it was interagency cooperation, bringing resources from Veterans Affairs to help house the veteran homeless population. And we were able to meet that goal within a year or within 18 months.
In a way that if you were just saying to everybody, come together, we've got to find solutions to this, doesn't accomplish.
That's right. And it's more than just bringing those financial resources. It's bringing data resources and human resources and a spirit of cooperation. I'm sure it happened very similarly in Minnesota. It was a process of sitting down in a room with the case managers and the people who could provide housing, rental agents or housing providers, and going through names one at a time and saying, where are we going to put this person?
Interesting. On Twitter here, Leah says, my 26-year-old brother has been homeless for a few years. My whole family has tried to help and support him. I believe the bottom line is mental health struggles and not having a safe and consistent place to sleep. And she says, looking forward to the show. This gets to something I did want to talk to you about, Kathy, which is there was a narrative that went around saying there are some people you will never be able to transition from homelessness to some kind of home because they want to be homeless. These are people that don't want to be helped. What do you think of that? What would you say to that narrative?
Yeah, well, I can tell you that I have worked on this issue for 25 years, and many of those years early on were in direct service. So I was working directly with people in homeless shelters experiencing homelessness. And I can honestly say that I have never met a single person who I believe chose to be homeless or wanted to be homeless. They may have been choosing between two options that they felt were both bad options.
Okay,
so one might be an overcrowded shelter or sleeping outside. They may choose to sleep outside. But when given the option of safe and stable housing with the supports they need, that's what people do.
Got it. To the phones here to Ricardo in Minneapolis. Hey, Ricardo, hi.
Hi.
What are you thinking about? What's your question?
Well, I live near Lake Hiawatha, and just this year we have noticed a huge increase in the number of people who have actually told us, as we've talked with them, that they're homeless. They're walking our alleys. They're sleeping in the park. And while it's been a little unnerving having just that much movement around in the neighborhood, both my wife and I haven't really felt threatened by it, but are also really concerned that, like, what's the change? Why have services changed over the last few years?
Good. Good question. Kind of what's going on in your neighborhood? Yeah. Kathy, do you know?
Yeah, I think I can help with that. So, you know, since we launched our statewide plan to prevent and end homelessness in 2014, we've actually seen a decrease in overall homelessness of about 8%, family homelessness of about 20%. But I can tell you that one of the most concerning trend lines is that we have seen an increase, and frankly, kind of a dramatic increase, in the number of people who are unsheltered all across the state, not just in the metro area, but in other areas as well. This is true in many cities across the country right now, and all the research is showing and all the data is showing that it has a lot to do, a very strong correlation with housing market conditions. And in Minnesota right now, we have an increasingly tight vacancy rate, increasing rents, and an increased inability of people to be able to afford the housing. And that is what we believe is leading to that increase.
I want to make sure I understand this. It seems like you're making a distinction between homelessness and unsheltered. And you're seeing this trend rise among the unsheltered. What does that say?
So there are homelessness. There are people who are in shelter that are considered homeless.
Okay.
And there are people who are unsheltered who are also considered homeless.
Just can't get into shelters.
And we are finding an increase in unsheltered.
Okay.
I think, frankly, we could not build a crisis response system big enough to address the housing need that we have in this state. And so as we have less and less housing that's affordable to people at the very lowest incomes, we are going to see more people who are without shelter.
Aaron, I want to talk about housing first here, too, as we start to get into some solutions. And my shorthand description was it doesn't require people to obey a number of rules, right? Be sober, be working, be getting mental health counseling before the priority of some kind of shelter is addressed. Is this where the activist community, the advocate community, is moving to try to address homelessness?
I think it is. It's something I first started hearing coming out of Ian DeYoung and his people at OrgCode, which is an activist group, sort of data-driven activism, I suppose, is the best word for it. And he liked to say, and I think this is a good way to put it, that you don't have to be housing ready. That's sort of a silly thing to say. We used to say people needed to be housing ready. And they don't need to be housing ready. They need to be housed. Saying housing ready is a lot like saying clothing ready or food ready. We don't think about those things in those terms, and we shouldn't think about housing that way either.
Kathy.
I have a great example of this, too. I mean, Housing First is really a change in the way that we think about doing this work over the last several years. And I think just a tremendous example is when I was working in Minneapolis and Hennepin County, when we launched our plan to prevent and end homelessness, one of the key parts of that was to develop an outreach team to work with the police department and try to better connect people to resources. Well, there was a gentleman who had been arrested and was homeless downtown Minneapolis. He was arrested about 133 times over the course of a few years. years. And so they'd arrest him. He'd go to court. They'd do whatever they do. He'd come back out. He'd get arrested again. He was getting arrested because he had serious and persistent mental health issues, and he was loitering and you know, some of the things you do when you are in that circumstance. Once he got connected to housing, they got him into housing, he was arrested in that next year only once.
So the resources of the courts and the police department and the rest of the system are not being used.
Yes. And if we would have waited for him to be quote unquote housing ready, he'd still be out there and he'd still be costing taxpayers enormous amounts of money.
Call here from Carrie in Minneapolis. Hey, Carrie. Hi.
Hello. Yes. So I have a question maybe that will shift the narrative a little bit here.
Okay.
But so there has been growing discussion statewide about deregulation as a way to cut costs in order to build more housing units. I've heard the concern of many affordable housing advocates regarding this narrative is that no specific regulations have been identified that would equate to a significant cost savings without compromising structural safety or labor standards or utility cost savings for property managers and residents. I think it's distracting from the message of actually coming up with real solutions and continued investments. So wondering if you have thoughts on this narrative and if there's any way to refocus.
Okay. So, Kathy, are we, when she says deregulation, are we talking about some of the zoning issues that the mayors are trying to use?
I'm assuming that's what you're referring to. I mean, one thing I will say is that the governor recently launched a task force on housing that includes both public and private partners, you know, from various sectors who are coming up with recommendations about how do we create a resilient housing system in the state that includes new development, new access for rental assistance, potentially changes or recommendations around zoning or regulations. So it'll be really interesting to see what those recommendations end up being. I think we see them as critically important to this work of preventing and ending homelessness, because we can do as much as we possibly can to coordinate and align with each other and target resources. But unless we have the housing in a variety of ways to get to that housing, we're not going to be successful.
I have to say, Erin, having talked with the mayor of Minneapolis, the newish mayor of Minneapolis and a city council president on this, you know, some of what they're talking about is going to address affordable housing, but it doesn't sound like it's going to produce the level of affordable housing that would really make that big of a difference to the urgency of what we're talking about today. What's your thought?
Well, I'm not as familiar as maybe I should be with Minneapolis.
No, that's fine. I just mean overall.
What we had happen here in Des Moines was a lot of what we might call gentrification. So we changed a lot of the rules and we tore down a lot of what used to be affordable housing and put other things in its place, or took old single-room occupancy buildings that used to address homelessness in a major way and replaced them with condos. That's great. I think it's made the city a lot more livable for people with money. It's also terrible because it's made it very hard to afford any place to live. There's a real shortage of affordable housing in Des Moines that I think is probably the case in Minneapolis as well. Minneapolis has grown a lot over the last few years, and its urban center has become
very
more
expensive.
Beautiful than it's ever been before.
Yeah.
Right? But at the cost of affordable housing.
Yeah, and I'll just add, in Minnesota, you know, in order to give data to that governor's task force, we know what the supply gap is based on income level. So for listeners, for a housing to be affordable, we typically say that somebody should pay no more than about 30% of their income for their housing. Otherwise, other things start to fall away. And there are, in Minnesota, over 280,000 households right now who pay more than that, the rental households that pay more than that for their housing. The majority of those are at that very low income range. And so we have, you know, a gap of housing for very low income people in Minnesota of over 100,000 units.
Which is why I was asking, are you really going to touch the chronically homeless population with these kinds of measures that we're talking about, you know, rezoning and those issues? I'm not saying it's not worth doing, but
I think it's going to take a combination of everything. It's going to take developing units that are truly affordable at the deepest levels. It's going to take rental assistance to make people be able to afford the existing market. It's going to take, you know, making sure we don't have overly restrictive tenant, requirements to get into housing, and it could be some zoning. So it's going to take a combination of things to get us out of this housing crisis.
Conversation this hour, if you've just tuned in, about homelessness, some approaching goals on this, some numbers about the urgency of homelessness in Minnesota and beyond. A lot of cities are dealing with this. Erin Stover Wright is with us from the Institute for Community Alliances in Des Moines, and Kathy Tenbroek, long-term advocate for homelessness, and she's now with the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. I'm asking a couple things from you. If you or someone in your family has experienced homelessness, I have a feeling that there are things that we miss about really understanding this, and I think that'd be valuable to this discussion. And then overall, how does this idea of housing first, going right to the shelter, thinking about the mental health counseling and the job applications and the sobriety on the second tier of that, how does that sound to you? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, where Emily says, I had the opportunity to go on St. Stephen's A Day in the Life walking tour of homelessness in Minneapolis. Kathy, you're familiar with this. Mm-hmm. She says, very informative and human look into the issue that highlighted insufficient shelters. To the phones here to Anna in Minneapolis. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
Hey, tell me what you wanted to add to the discussion.
Well, I just wanted to comment. I work for a nonprofit in the metro that serves individuals who have serious and persistent mental illness. And I can just speak to the firsthand knowledge and experience that I've had trying to connect with people who are experiencing chronic homelessness or unstable housing, and how much time and effort that takes. And we're willing to put in that work, but just for people to be aware, when there's a question of taxpayer dollars, that it does end up costing one way or another. And I think this was also kind of commented on with the narrative around court costs. It also translates into huge costs for emergency room visits and crisis bed stays, and people not following through on health care because they just don't have a stable place to be to start from.
Okay.
And so it just kind of mushrooms into all of these other areas of a person's life. And so without having that stable place to land, there's really no place to start from.
I think, Anna, correct me if this isn't right, I think I hear you saying when you're thinking about bang for the buck, taxpayer investment, you have to be aware of all the other ancillary costs that happen when you have someone who is homeless, and you're measuring that against something like housing first.
Yes. And I correlate the housing question is also being a huge public health issue.
Okay.
And translating into quality of life and people's ability to be able to contribute to society. And so it's a very complicated issue, and I don't think it's solved by one answer, but that people should consider a lot of different things go into this very complex issue.
Kathy, go ahead.
I think that's a wonderful point, Anna. And I think, you know, we do spend a lot of time right now in this, particularly in this conversation, talking about costs and cost savings of ending someone's homelessness. I also think it's just really important to point out that the majority of people who are experiencing homelessness in this state are children. They are children, and they are young people who are homeless on their own, and they are our future. They're our future workforce. You know, we have identified, you know, last October when we do enrollment for schools all across the state, there were 8,700 homeless and highly mobile students enrolled on that one day. And that directly correlates to academic achievement. You know, those kids are doing about 20 percentage points less able to read and have math proficiency in grade 3 as their housed but equally poor counterparts. So it's so important. Housing stability, yes, it's about cost savings. It's also about employers being able to find employees and educators being able to educate children for our future and reducing disparities. It impacts so many things that we care about in our state.
Teresa says, what's the status of foreclosed empty homes across the state? Property as investment is also a huge problem. Families, not investors, should have first shot at buying fixer-upper homes. And then I'm going to grab a call here for you, Erin, from Larry in Minneapolis. Hey, Larry, what's your question?
Well, I'm an attorney who in Minneapolis who works with low-income tenants.
Okay.
And one of the things I see is when people get into public and subsidized housing, unfortunately, there are federal rules that allow for eviction if the person has engaged in any kind of drug activity on or off the property. And so you'll find someone who's like lease compliant in the property, but they do something off the property and they get evicted for it. And I was just wondering if there are any efforts going to either encourage housing authorities to not go down that road or to change the federal laws that allow them.
Aaron, what would you say to that?
I think eviction is a huge problem. Matthew Desmond and his new eviction lab is a great source of data on that. And it varies by municipality, but yes, we see that not only are people most vulnerable getting evicted, especially Matthew Desmond has shown that having a child is a very strong indicator for potential eviction. So just having a kid in your household, especially if you're a single mother, dramatically increases the probability of eviction. And then once you're evicted, the ability to get rehoused goes up. I talked to case managers here in Iowa who lament how hard it is to house somebody who's already been evicted. It just closes off the pool of potential places people can go.
And
there's
just
only so many.
Aaron, if I may understand that, because that goes into some record that the next potential landlord can access?
Right. Well, if it goes through the courts, then yes.
Okay.
If there's a court record of an eviction, if it gets handled outside of court, of course, there's no record. But yes, it's very easy to find out if a potential renter has been evicted in the past.
Okay. Kathy, I wanted to ask you about something that as I was reading the key principles that the organization that you're with has come up with to address homelessness, you use the words person-centered, trauma-informed. I mean, is that something that needs to be stated because it hasn't been, people are not aware of that as they come to try to solve the problem?
Yeah, I think it's really showing that we have a strong value in Minnesota to make sure that whatever solutions we are coming up with are informed by people with lived experience of homelessness themselves, what they need, what will work for them, what will work for their children and their families. And that hasn't always been the case.
Okay, ask you that. I mean, if you want a standard of trauma-informed, it's suggesting that hasn't been the lead concern. Why?
Yeah. Well, I think that for many years, we thought, here's the solution to homelessness X. And
okay.
We sort of put it out there as this is what we're going to do. And over time, after, doing this work for many, many years, we've learned that there's no one size fits all for any one individual or family. And so you really need to work on an individual basis. We're doing something now across the state and really across the country that I know Aaron can speak to as well, called coordinated entry, where we're trying to, when we work with a family or individual, really understand what they need and what they want and try to connect them to the resource that will work best for them, as opposed to saying, here's what we have, take it or leave it. I mean, we've really advanced in that way. Unfortunately, the challenge is we don't always have enough of what those families and individuals need.
How has that changed the way you're working on this, Aaron?
Well, traditionally, more often than not, if somebody was homeless, they would present at whatever was the most convenient shelter. So the new approach then is that when a person becomes homeless, you'll put them in shelter immediately, however that works out. But then there's two sets of analysis you do of that person. First, to determine if they're likely to die soon. So that's your first priority, is make sure that people who face increased probability of mortality.
Wow.
Get help immediately.
Uh-huh, right.
And then the second half is what Kathy was talking about, which is try to match that person to the sort of response that's most likely to help them in the long run. So if somebody shows up at the homeless shelter, maybe that's what they need, or maybe they need to get into some sort of a transitional housing situation or permanent supportive housing or rapid rehousing. We've got all these different ways of addressing people's problems. And it was a much more haphazard assignment of those resources.
Okay.
And now we're trying to be very systematic and very intentional about the way we use our resources so that we can go further.
Okay, to the phones to Tracy and Marshall. Hey, Tracy, thanks so much for waiting.
Thank you for taking my call.
It sounds like you have some experience with this.
Oh, absolutely. So I've been facing homelessness on and off since 1992. And in 2012, I was evicted twice from the same place in Minneapolis. And I was fighting an addiction as well. And finally, in 2014, I put myself in treatment, and I thought that would be the key to finally finding some stable housing. And unfortunately, that did end up happening, but not through the treatment center as I thought it would. I did end up taking my kids after I finished the treatment and going to Willmar, Minnesota, to a shelter. Mm-hmm. And they helped me get an apartment in Benson, Minnesota. So then while I was in Benson, Minnesota, I was given a Section 8 certificate, and we established some roots finally. And I have put myself through school.
Yeah.
I'm currently working for Project Turnabout. I'm doing my internship as a chemical dependency counselor.
Fantastic.
I have relinquished my Section 8 certificate so another family can use it. And I'm moving now closer to Marshall. And so I feel like I am a success.
Well, I feel like that too, and I think you've made Kathy's day by calling in here.
Yeah, Tracy, thank you so much for sharing that story.
Tracy, if I may ask, since you called in, when you were on the precipice of homelessness, I mean, what would it have taken, I guess, for some organization or somebody to step in to stop what began what sounded like a multi-year kind of situation? I mean, what might have stopped it from ever happening?
I'm glad you asked me that question, because as a matter of fact, while I was going through the first eviction, I reached out to a program, and I can't remember what the program is today, but I reached out to a program who helped me pay the back rent that I owed.
Okay.
But there was no continuing help.
Got it.
And my income at the time, I was on MFIB, so my rent was $750, and my MFIB grant was $620. So
okay.
Every month I was behind. And when this, so I won that one, although it still is on my record. The second one, they would, that same program wouldn't help me again. So essentially really what I needed was, I needed some treatment, for my chemical dependency. And two, I needed help establishing a consistent way of paying my rent.
Got it. Yeah. You needed somebody to come in, step in with the back rent, give you a little bit of breathing room, and then address the chemical addiction. I'm really glad you called, Tracy. Kathy, thoughts on her experience?
Yeah. I mean, Tracy, thank you very much for taking the time to call in. And I'm sorry for all you've been through. And I'm grateful that you are where you are now. I think, you know, Tracy's story is just making me think about the elements of really what it takes to prevent an end homelessness in for a person or a community.
Right.
And, you know, the first one is to prevent and divert that homelessness in the first place whenever possible. And so that has to be a big focus of the work that we do. And then if somebody does become homeless, we need to try to make sure it is as short as possible and that it doesn't happen again. And that's where the kind of support services or connection to supports that maybe Tracy needed or others need to make sure that they can maintain that housing stability is so critical. That's what ending homelessness really means, is that we have all those pieces in place.
Erica says on Twitter, I've come to realize what a catch-22 housing is for homeless. When they don't get sleep at night, or it's very broken up because it's too dangerous to fall asleep anywhere, it's hard to function during the day. Housing could solve many issues to stop the cycle. I wanted to play an excerpt from a story that our reporter Nina Moyney did on homelessness and what's happening with the light rail system. And I think you're going to hear from Chris Knutson here with the Minneapolis nonprofit St. Stephen's Human Services addressing this idea of constantly interrupted sleep.
The most sleep you're going to get is, you know, 20 minutes here, 20 minutes there. You're constantly having to worry about who else is on the train. It's noisy. It's bright.
Yeah. A look there from Nina overall at what it means to be homeless and how light rail is becoming the kind of shelter because there isn't enough emergency housing for people. You know, Aaron, I should ask you what occurred to you as you listened to Tracy's experience with this. And I was asking about you know, interrupting what seemed to be the inevitable move towards homelessness. What do you think?
Sure. Well, I had really, I think, two thoughts. The first thing that kept occurring to me over and over again was the thought that housing really is a form of therapy for most of the people experiencing any sort of substance abuse problems, mental health problems. Getting into housing is the first step to recovery. It's not something that happens along the way. You really can't address those other problems while you're worried about where you're going to live if you're on the trains or the skywalks. The other thing that kept occurring to me is that as we look across a longer time span, so right now we're talking year to year, but if you take maybe 10 years and you look at the numbers, most of the people who become homeless really do become homeless one time. They make it as short as they can. They get what they need, and then they move on to stability for the long run.
Huh.
It's that subpopulation that's chronically homeless or homeless for more than a few months at a time that becomes problematic and harder to serve. Most of those people who are homeless are working to some degree. That maybe they need a little more work. Maybe they need a different work. But most of them are just have one or two deficits that they need to address. They're aware of what those deficits are, putting extra burdens on them as they try to find stability isn't useful.
Doesn't make sense, yeah.
No.
Kimberly's tweeting, I just passed a mom with a three-year-old with a homeless sign in Coon Rapids, bought her groceries 6 months ago. How best to help? And Kathy, I think I can see some of that on the Twitter feed today. So what do you do individually?
Yeah, I mean, I think individually in those circumstances, it's absolutely, you know, an individual call. I think what's so challenging to me about that issue is that I sometimes see that handing the dollar out the window and people feel like they did something to assist. And I guess my call to action to the broader community is that we are better than that, that is a really undignified way to receive help. Not that what that person did wasn't a beautiful thing.
But that's a really good way to put it.
Yeah, right? And so I just feel like do that, but then go home and call your elected officials and talk to your leaders in your community and say, this is unacceptable. This is not how we should get people the services they need.
You were saying that part of that is getting the private sector, the community involved in this too, beyond just government agencies.
Oh,
how are you harnessing their power?
Yeah, well, you know, homelessness, I think, you know, just its core, it's a very solvable issue. And I think, you know, we are starting to build the kind of will in the community to recognize that everyone has a role to play in solving homelessness, whether you're a government agency or a private sector leader or a faith community leader or a business, you know, an employer, everybody can play a role. And so when we launched Heading Home Together, which is our most recent iteration of our statewide plan to prevent and end homelessness, it is launched in a way that is in partnership and collaboration with many sectors across the state. So this is not a government plan. This is actually a plan that all of those sectors are leading and supporting and have, you know, shared ownership of. So we have a Heading Home Together leadership circle that's co-chaired by the Poled Family Foundation and the state. We've got people with lived experience of homelessness sitting on that leadership circle, helping to guide the work along with counties and tribal partners and community leaders. And that's how we feel like we're really going to make the biggest progress, is that it's going to take all of us to solve this.
Erin, Kathy said something interesting there, which is it's solvable. I wonder if, you know, not with any malice, but that we've become pretty accustomed to thinking of homelessness as something that is unsolvable and we're going to just have to live with it.
Oh, no, it's very solvable.
I'm not saying it isn't solvable. I'm saying, do you think part of the, you know, resistance, I don't know, the activating people is because this perception has settled in?
Right. I think, yes. I think you get used to seeing something. Also, I think it's very hard for most people to see it as a system. The housing system exists in a, you know, all the way to the top, the person who has investment properties is impacting the system as a whole, forcing people to live doubled and tripled up to afford rents is a part of the problem. That there's just this, all of those things combined create what we call a structural gap at the bottom. There's just not enough affordable housing. And like Kathy said, call your representatives and encourage them, because those are where the rules are set. Right now, the rules encourage one kind of construction, the rules could very well encourage a different kind of construction. If we want to encourage the construction of affordable, quality housing, we could by putting the incentives there.
Got it. Kathy?
Carrie, if I could just add, I mean, I think you make a really good point. I think people have become very complacent. People are used to seeing, you know, visible signs of homelessness, and they think it's always been that way and it'll always be that way. But, you know, we created homelessness in this country. You know, it has not always been the kind of homelessness that we see today. You know, between urban renewal and deinstitutionalization in the 60s and massive budget cuts to our housing and urban development budget in the 80s. And, you know, there were policy decisions that led us here. And it's going to take policy decisions to get us out of this.
You know, have you been reading about what's going on in San Francisco?
A little bit, yeah.
So, as you know, I mean, a liberal city run by a pretty liberal city council, but members of that city council now saying maybe the answer is just moving all of the homeless people out of the city because people who live in San Francisco are tired of seeing it. You're shaking your head on that. I know that doesn't sound like a well thought out solution, but San Francisco seems to be at their wit's end, having tried a number of different things.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think San Francisco is one of the least affordable cities in the country. And once again, the direct correlation between a housing market failure and homelessness is there. And so unless they address the actual housing needs of people at the very lowest income, and I know that's hard for any one city or one state to do, it's going to take all levels of government and really bipartisan support to do that. That's why our work on veteran homelessness, I think, is the best example. At the federal level, bipartisan support with new investments, we should have that same bipartisan support for ending children homelessness, for example. And hopefully we will get there.
Call here from Joe in Buffalo. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Tell me your story.
Years ago, probably 25 years ago, I was homeless for a little while. I was just living in my car. I wasn't that bad of a deal. It was in the winter or anything. But recently, I was self-employed for 2 years, and I was renting from my business partner, and he decided he was going to close down the business. And so the house that I was renting from him, so since I had no proof of income or rental history, didn't have a whole lot of options available. And unfortunately, my mom and dad were able to loan me some money because the rental property that I got into, they wanted a significant down payment for me to get in there. And he had bought the home just a month earlier as an investment. And I think the rent is a little high, but anyway, that's beside the point. But my thought is that with all of these homes that are, you know, already foreclosed on, owned by the bank, and been sitting dormant for months or even years, I think it would make more sense for the cities to just buy them.
Yeah.
If they have to put a little bit of money into them and then sell them at a reasonable price, because aside from the mental health issues or the drug addiction issues, there's other people that have just fallen on hard times, lost a job and had to take a job with significant pay cut, and they just can't afford to.
Joe, if I might, you've brought up a really good question that I wanted to get to, and I'm seeing some other questions about this on Twitter. Aaron, questions about what about some of these properties that cities have on the books? Yes, they would take some reconstruction and retrofitting. Why are they not part of the solution or a larger enough part of it?
Well, they could be. They have been before. I know here in Des Moines, at one point, we moved a number of properties off of the public record into private nonprofits' hands. They did a lot of the retrofitting in cooperation with Habitat for Humanity. And it worked great. And in fact, it created a little trust fund that was then used to address homelessness more broadly. Yes, it's a great solution. It takes political will and making it happen. I've never seen it done in an ongoing fashion. I've seen it done intermittently.
I see. Okay. To Marjorie in Lake Elmo. Hi, Marjorie. It sounds like you've had some experience with this.
I have. I have an older brother. He's 74, and he is what I believe Asperger's or undiagnosed autistic brother, who has been homeless on and off for years. And unfortunately, affordable housing is not just a problem in Minnesota, it's across the country. In California, they have a 15-year waiting list for affordable housing. And so what they do is they put people on a list, and you literally crisscross the country trying to find affordable housing.
Wow. Is your brother, so has he, is he homeless at the moment?
He is homeless at the moment. Okay. He's living in a tent in the mountains.
Wow. So Kathy, aging and homelessness. This is another part of the complexity of this.
Yeah. One of the, Marjorie, thanks for your call. And I'm sorry to hear about your brother. One of the rising numbers of people experiencing homelessness in our communities are seniors. And, you know, of course, the percent of that increase is very similar to the percent of seniors aging in the general population as well. So it's not a surprise, but it is very concerning because, as we all know, seniors can be enormously vulnerable.
And they're getting priced out. Is this what you would say? They're getting priced out of their housing?
Yeah, they can't afford the housing that they're in or can't afford the housing that's available. They're unable to age in their community, which is something that I think should be a high value for all of us to focus on ensuring that can happen. And some seniors are sleeping on shelter floors, and maybe they have something in their past, you know, an eviction record or criminal history, and it could be even long ago, and they're still not able to find housing. And these are sometimes, I mean, up to 85 years old, sleeping on mats on floors. So, I mean, talk about unacceptable. So there's it's something for the broader community to understand as well, that we're not just talking about somebody they might see on a street corner.
Right.
We're talking about children. We're talking about seniors. We're talking about really youth, young people on their own. We're talking about everybody.
Yeah. I want to grab a question here from James in Owatonna here. James, I think you want to talk about being from a smaller town and what to do about it. Yes?
Yes, yes. I'm from Owatonna, Minnesota. We have about 24,000 people here,
okay.
And we do have a shelter here. We call it the Friendship House. And I was a guest there. But in a small town, you get this good old boy attitude, kind of like they do not want to see it, right?
Uh-huh.
They do not want to believe it. So how do you keep this topic alive in a small town?
Okay.
That really, yeah, it's interesting. And
Aaron,
I was a guest there.
James, thanks so much for the call. It's a really good question. Aaron, what would you say about that?
Well, I would say that your guest noticed something that's absolutely true. Rural homelessness looks different than urban homelessness. And the rural mindset around homelessness is different, and the solution, therefore, also needs to be somewhat different. You find a lot more doubled up in rural spaces, and you find a lot more informal rental agreements in rural spaces. So it's good that they have a shelter program. I would encourage people to get involved with their local shelters. A lot of times, though, if there's not a shelter, those people end up having to migrate, to find work or find services. Usually, with work in mind, they'll move to a more rural space, which compounds the problem because it cuts them off from their healthy social networks.
Right. Good point.
Yeah. So finding ways to address rural homelessness has been an ongoing problem, and it's not getting any easier.
Aaron, good to have your view and your experience in the discussion today. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Aaron Stover-Wright from the Institute for Community Alliances in Des Moines. This goes back to, Kathy, the question about, I saw a mother with her child. What do I do in the moment? We got a call a few minutes ago from Ali in Minneapolis who says, I'm curious about the people I see at the crossroads on the highways asking for money. What's known about them?
Yeah, some years ago when I was in Minneapolis and Hennepin County, we did a survey, a pretty extensive survey of everybody we could identify that was panhandling in Minneapolis. And the majority of them were indeed experiencing literal homelessness at that moment. Some of them were in housing, but they were making so little money and had very little left over that they were panhandling for things like medications and food and that kind of thing. So the needs are real. And so people should be treated with deep respect. But as I mentioned earlier, I think that that whole system of how we've, you know, evolved in our communities to accept that as an option for getting connected to service and resource is really just very undignified.
Kathy, thank you. I see you bring a lot of energy and commitment to this. So
thank you
very
much.
Thanks for coming
Carrie.
In to talk about
Appreciate
it.
Appreciate it.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.